The Tom Woods Show, episode 975.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, it's time to say goodbye to those $99 suits on the clearance rack. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $379 at Indochino.com when entering Woods at checkout. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. What an interesting guest we have today. It's Patrick Schumacher, who is an architect and architectural theorist based in London. He is the principal of the architecture practice Zaha Hadid Architects and has been there since 1988. He became rather notorious in particular last year after delivering a speech before other architects on his views of the state of architecture and of what public policy ought to be with regard to public housing, public spaces, privatization. He gave a sweeping, I guess I would say, Austro-libertarian analysis of pretty much everything, and it just knocked everybody into some kind of crazed state they haven't quite yet recovered from. And he's not backing down. He's sticking by what he had to say, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy hearing from him. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Good to talk to you.
I'm right now looking at this notorious article now from November of 2016, talking about you. And, of course, the headline is the subheadline refers to your extreme views and they're causing outrage and on and on. They don't say that about people who have views opposite of yours. They say that about you in particular. And they start off by saying, and this is the first sentence of the article: abolish social housing, scrap prescriptive planning regulations, and usher in the wholesale privatization of our streets, squares, and parks. That was the message, they say, that you delivered to a stunned audience of architects and developers at a conference in Berlin last week, provoking a flood of impassioned responses online. And you've been declared the Trump of architecture, if only he favored privatization the way you do. But let's, before we get into the details here, had anybody known that you had views that were, let's say, of the sort that would shock The Guardian before you delivered that speech?
Some people did. I've been proselytizing for my libertarian views for quite a while, but not with so much media attention. This was more in smaller circles, perhaps, at various lectures and seminars, more in academic circumstances. Actually, it was at a London Property Conference. I was sitting in the front row combating a series of the panelists there and brought them out of their kind of usual Sunday speech boredom. So, but yeah, nothing hit the headlines, nothing hit the fan before. So that was a shock in a way.
So you have, I got to meet you briefly at the Mises Institute a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And just judging from the article alone, you do have pretty, you have views that to a libertarian would seem fairly standard. But as sure, with many of our views, to the average person, the average person is going to have a heart attack over some of these. So I'm curious, first of all, about the world of architecture and if your views are really so extreme. Like in the tech world, for example, there are a lot of leftists, but there are people, there are libertarians who just keep their heads down and are quiet. So I'm curious about that. And secondly, how did you come to adopt these views in the first place?
Well, great question. Yeah, it's different from the tech world. I'm familiar with the tech world also, and there you get much more respect for capitalism, for entrepreneurship, for libertarian conceptions, because these people really want to change the world and be free to do so, and they need that entrepreneurial freedom. In architecture, there is less of this, far less. We are much more used to think of the state as a client, particularly when it comes to urban planning. It's nearly unquestioned, taken for granted that the state takes the leading role. And in general, I would say academic disciplines like architecture and many others, they have this, I think, hangover, I would call it, this inertia of being left liberal, strongly left liberal, majority-wise oriented, and with very few exceptions. There are a few characters, particular people coming maybe from Eastern Europe into London, etc., who learned something, have different opinions, But certainly my view is very, very much minority view, and the standard view is a left liberal view.
And you used to be on the left, you told me.
Yes, I was on the left. I was. I have a lifelong search and interest in how society works, how politics works, how we could accelerate, let's say, the human project. And when I was much younger, I actually started in my mid-20s, early-20s, in fact, I was interested in philosophy, and I was drawn to Marxism and the work of Marx. And I think it's still a great inspiration as a figure, somebody who said, I am thinking through the destiny of humanity. I'm taking the responsibility for human progress onto my shoulder, and I'm trenchant in critiquing what has been thought through so far in this arena. And he was an incredible, eager learner. So I was attracted to Marx and also the Marxist movement. At the time it was in Germany, we were all brought up in a kind of an anti-communist hysteria. So I was attracted to the Marxist at that time because it wasn't so mainstream. And so I wasn't a kind of softy left liberal. I was more of a radical Marxist who was more like kick-ass, professionalized cater parties, leadership. A lot of themes of the Marxists are still, I think, resonating, not particularly this, but the idea that human progress and appraisal of its chances with respect to various political regimes or social institutions needs to be based on an economics understanding, on the understanding that we need to reproduce materially and progress and have productivity gains as a very, very important critical aspect to reflect. So that, in a sense, carries over. And when I look at what I'm now interested in, I discovered the Austrian school and Austrian economics, in fact, through you, Tom, it was the shock of 2008. By that time, I wasn't a Marxist anymore. I had become a kind of mainstream figure. I was happy with the neoliberal revolution to some extent, but I still had kind of, would maybe consider myself a kind of Blairite, modernized social democrat. And I was interested in philosophers like maybe Jürgen Habermas, and Niklas Luhmann, who was more maybe pro-market oriented, but really the financial crisis shocked me, and I wasn't prepared to think of kind of left solutions to this. And I was looking out for solutions. I came across Meltdown, your book, and it really made sense. It ran open doors in a way. I seemed to have been ready for this message, and I drilled deep into Austrian economics, and I find it very compelling and convincing. And in a sense, it re-radicalized me, and it satisfied my urge to think out of the box and not just go along with the kind of mainstream recipes and searching. There must be something else, because progress is slow. We've been stagnating for too long, and it really caught me there. So that was the trigger.
Well, first of all, I'm thrilled to hear that. That's very kind of you to point out. I'm glad that it did some good in your case, and you know, I'm
surely did.
It was rough to write that book because I had to do it so quickly. Oh, but I'm glad that the results, the results have been so good. So I want to go through and look at your heretical views here.
Sure.
Let's start with what will seem, I think, to most people to be the most shocking. When they use the term social housing, is that is that a British term for public housing?
Yeah, it's public housing. It's a whole system now of, let's say, the affordability system. It's a rationing of what they're talking about now is 50% of all new built development in the residential space is meant to be rationed out with very heavy subsidies, anywhere between 20%, that's the minimum, all the way to 50%, sometimes 60% subsidy, and distributed, rationed out to people who accumulate in queues, and it's very laborsome and cumbersome for people to kind of line up into these queues. For each project, they have to line up. And then it's distributed to groups which they call key workers or in different groups and different projects. So it's difficult to criticize because there's no general set of rules and policies. But that's what they call, let's say, the umbrella term is social housing. It also includes partial subsidized, partial purchases to bring people on the so-called housing ladder. It includes just give away, I mean, rent supported, cheaper rents, as well as just given away to people who don't have any income as well. It's a very, very mixed field, and it's no longer all state provided, the so-called housing associations, which are charitable entities mostly, who do get some government grant, but mostly it's financed through that other half of still privately sold and rented flats. And they, in a sense, carry the burden of these huge subsidies. So as we subsidize one group, we're burdening and make it more expensive for the rest, which means that we're increasing inaffordability through affordable housing. That's one of my points. And we bring more people, push out of that private market. And that's what they've been doing. Then they have also increased then the eligibility criterion from, you know, let's say £50,000 a year, now 60, 70, 80,000 then, and now it's at £90,000 earning, which is a really good earning usually. With this kind of salary, you're still eligible. You still kind of now join that queue, since this whole set of policies have made the apartments so much expensive and turned you into some kind of recipient of a rationing process. I'm just pointing out the irrationality of this, the way it contributes to the very crisis it's meant to ameliorate. But then I'm also pointed out all these supply restrictions, planning restrictions, the political interference with the development process, the delays which come through this, which drive up prices.
Okay, you know, I maybe spoke too soon when I said that's the most controversial position, because as I'm thinking about it, that may not in fact be. It turns out that even before this article in The Guardian, where you really, really started getting some attention, there was, you've been quoted, people are going and finding what you're writing on Facebook and writing articles about it. Yep. So you apparently wrote something on Facebook about why we should not publicly fund art schools anymore, and that this should all be shut down. What is your justification for that? Apart from taxation is theft, what else do you have to say?
Well, this was actually what I always look at it on two sides. One is the cost of these provisionings and the incentives they create, but also on the receiving end, a lot of these grants, I think they become, and subsidies, they become a poison chalice. And that's even for research grants, I would say, publicly granted research grants, grants to the arts, grants to art schools. In a way, they take the juice out of, and they kind of sedated, kind of palliatives, they kind of poison chalices. So I think it's bad for the arts to be supported in this way. And in particular, what I was pointing out, the art world is a necessary element within contemporary societies. It's the freewheeling, unrestrained brainstorming chamber where new ideas, new technologies, half-finished, raw experiments can try out, get resources, maybe through the private art market, maybe through mystification. But unrestrained, there is no easy rationality. Precisely like in a brainstorming exercise, the arts depend on that total looseness, total freedom, this total freewheeling otherness to what one can justify at that stage, to have that mutation chamber, that browsing chamber, to then come in and creative professionals who have rational agendas to select out, be inspired, experience the reaction of audience with respect to new aesthetics, for instance, and then make products out of this. So that was a bit of a more complicated argument. But again, these arguments are sometimes subtle and complex. But what happens in the media world, of course, I get some interesting responses, but then I also get these kind of ripping out the headline and running of this and laughing at something absurd and indefensible, why I do have my reasoning and arguments. And a similar thing, I would say, what people don't understand, the arguments about privatization of all public spaces, streets, parks, etc., that there is an argument to be had, that this is actually enhancing public space for the many publics in which contemporary societies differentiate itself, and that the current government bureaucratic provision of a one-fit-all kind of banal and boring and maybe over-policed standard public space is a huge waste of resources. And we would expect the kind of flourish of this resource of public space. If we had private entrepreneurs running with these spaces.
All right, more with Patrick Schumacher after we thank our sponsor. All right, I think we all know in the abstract that if you want to look your best, you want to have a made-to-measure suit instead of one you just pick up off the rack. But you think, well, what am I, a millionaire? I can't afford a suit like that. But you can with Indochino. $379 for a made-to-measure suit, and it's easy to do. You can measure yourself very easily. They show you exactly how to do it to get the size measurements they need to give you the suit that will fit you best. In fact, you can customize your suit. You can choose from hundreds of top quality fabrics, personalize it just the way you want it, including lapels and pleats and jacket linings and all kinds of things. I found it easy and very user-friendly to place an order at Indochino.com. Well, this week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $379. At Indochino.com when entering Woods at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit, plus free shipping. So that's Indochino.com using promo code Woods for any premium suit for just $379 and free shipping. That's an amazing deal for a suit that'll fit you better than anything off the rack ever could. So check it out at Indochino.com, promo code Woods. Tell me right now what's wrong with architecture.
Well, architecture at the moment is stifled by planning bureaucracies. The urban development process is stifled by very old and restrictive land use plans. It's kind of stifled by the most ludicrously detailed standards about what a housing development should look like in terms of its quantum, in terms of its unit mix, in terms of how many apartments per core, the sizes of each type of dwelling, the size of each single room, and the facilities in each of those rooms. I mean, it is absolutely ludicrous. So basically, architects, there's nothing left for us to do, because the planners then also come in and want the aesthetic articulation to be prescribed so that it fits into kind of an urban ensemble and so on and so forth. And the developers, the entrepreneurs, they have nothing to compete on because everything is pre-given. What they're competing on in the end is only to try to kind of game those planners' rules or negotiate with planners, because in the UK they have more discretion. That means give them more power. In America, at least, you have some strict rules. There's zoning, there's density prescriptions, and then the entrepreneur and architect can run with this within that envelope. In the UK, you have to kind of negotiate and argue. And this takes an enormous amount of time, but it's not about innovating the product. It's all about maybe increasing the quantity a little bit, maybe getting the affordability component reduced a little bit. It's really stifling. And London, you know, we have 500 projects going up here, and they're all cast in that same boring, deadly fashion, which is something we could have designed and built 80 years ago. I call it neo-rationalism. It's something very, very bland, very, very standard, which fits this kind of non-offensive. And there's a huge opportunity lost in terms of generating vibrancy. And in this growing city, this is the fastest growing city in the world. As I said, we're building 200 towers here at the moment and an overall 500, 600 projects on site. But it's kind of blandness. And it's not enough. There should be much more. And the product is this one fits all. And only those entrepreneurs, which I discovered, and we're working with one of them, this kind of guy in his 20s, who found that loophole for so-called multi-occupancy homes and created this kind of shared living collective hub, where suddenly he's pretending he's building a single house with 500 bedrooms gathered around a series of living rooms. And then you're really talking about excitement and a new product. And it's very competitive. And it shows how much craving there is in the market for something new, for something much smaller than what is prescribed standards. I mean, politicians think they can tell us, you know, that it is undignified to live in a certain amount of square meter. No, people feel in their bone that they want to be in the center, and they're quite happy with a very smaller patch. But we have this paternalistic view that we should prevent kind of the self-exploitation of professionals who want to, and prevent them from being kind of inverted commas forced into chicken hatches or something. I mean, there's so much false ideology. It's so stifling. And that's why we, as a London firm, we flourish all around the outside in the developing world. where you don't have much of that yet, and you have real entrepreneurship and real experimentation.
After you gave that speech that got all this attention,
I think it
surprised you, the scope and the extent of the response and the intensity of the response. You did have some supporters, no doubt, but in your field, certainly, this was like you'd thrown a stink bomb into the room. And I think you didn't, my sense is you didn't quite know where to go from there except to maybe keep your head down for a little while. But now, all of a sudden, here you are on my show talking freely again. So what's changed?
Well, look, I'm running this professional organization, and we're depending on clients trusting us as being a safe pair of hands who are sensible and understand the rules of the game. And so I felt a bit rattled when suddenly I'm, the new Hitler, the new Trump, where I'm, my picture appears with a mustache. Hitler mustache, where I'm called the fascist.
But of course, Hitler wanted to plan. He wanted urban planning.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all inverse. But the fascism label, defamation, this idea of being a persona non grata, being attention seeking, is also this idea that you bring it on, you just want to provoke. None of this is true. I wanted to have a sensible conversation. I wanted to open up the debate. But there's so much kind of emotional charge and toxicity. So yeah, I had to pull away a little bit. And also my company, my people, my board of directors, they got a little bit worried. But as the dust settled and I realized this is going to be news only once, I'm slowly coming out. And also, you see, there is this kind of sense that I'm the only one thinking these things. But a lot of people underneath, they might not be willing to say it. They know that these positions are offensive, but I got a lot of moral support in one-to-ones, in messages, in, hey, guy, Patrick, it's great. You finally say something about this. I feel like you understand where you're coming from. So I got a lot of this support also. And slowly, as the big kind of Twitter and Facebook and media storm that dust settled, I came out again, and I was on various other conversations. I was giving lectures, I had debates, and without fearing that this is another news item, and it had been a news item, so it's old news now, so I feel in a sense free to come out more again and get a sensible discourse going. That's what it is for me. I'm not into sensationalism of any kind.
What would you say are any encouraging trends that you see?
Well, in fact, I feel that, as I said earlier, there's a lot of people underneath the surface. There is willingness to criticize what's been going on. And people sense there's a lot of hypocrisy in the discourse. And these kind of left-liberal views, the way they kind of shield themselves from criticism, is becoming problematic. I also find it very positive that in universities, with the youth, you have, for the first time, interest in libertarian ideas and liberal ideas. The left isn't the only, still the majority option here, but it's not the only intellectual option. That there's a real serious intellectual discourse happening, which isn't tying in with all the left ideological positions. So I think that's very positive, and I've seen that, and that's something new. And I think the Mises Institute and people like you have a lot to be thanked for in this direction. And I think that's encouraging. And I think a lot of people sense also that this vilification of people who speak out is problematic. And I also had some others defending me publicly, maybe not my views directly, but saying, hey, let these positions be aired. That doesn't mean that this guy is now a kind of horrible, nasty, Mr. Nasty and the persona non grata. So I got a lot on that front. And there's been a great organization here in London called the Institute of Ideas. They're hosting the Battle of Ideas. They're really trying to roll back this kind of PC silencing of free speech, frankness. I think this ideology of over fragility and safe places and no platforming, that's crumbling. I see that crumbling. And I think it's interesting. Still things happen. I saw your recent podcast, heard it on the firing of that guy at Google who spoke out against a lot of these, I always think, really questionable pro-diversity policies. And that this guy was fired. I think it's horrendous. It's a shame. I love Google. It's a fantastic organization. But I think that brought out a lot of voices against such an act. And I think it's positive. I think that left ideology is on its last legs, I think, at least I hope, at least in terms of being so dominant, being so untouchable. I think that's crumbling. That's crumbling as we speak.
Do you have advice for young people entering your field?
Well, it's an exciting field still. The world is developing. The urbanization process is going on around the world, and it's a global industry. It's an expert industry. So I think it's still an exciting place. I would say yes. Don't be a traditionalist in the field. Invest in skills. We've been heavily invested in computational skills, computational methodologies, algorithmic working. AI is coming in heavily into our field. Evolutionary algorithms. It's exciting. It's a lot. It absorbs a lot of the tech intelligence. It is absorbs a lot of new technology, science, robotics. On that level, it's a very exciting field. But I suspect one should come in with an open mind, but with a sense that this discipline and field is evolving, and not so much, I would argue, with a sense of nostalgia for cozy village cities, etc. That's still happening as well. I mean, I'm not excluding that. Preservation is still ongoing, but we have preserved our historic centers already. That's all kind of covered. So I would invite people in who have the excitement for transforming the urban environment, because we have this new wave of urban concentration, which I think has a lot to do with what I call the post-fortis network society, where we have to concentrate and in dense urban networks where we interact a lot of research development work, creative work, marketing, financing, whereas the actual downstream production is more and more taking place in robots and robotic and automation. And we are in the city, that super brain, which is reprogramming and reinventing what the output of these production facilities should be. And that makes the city very exciting because it becomes that creative hub. And it needs a lot of architects to build and rebuild and develop that, because we're in the transformation from this era of suburbanization in the 20th century, pulling that back together in these great metropolitan centers. And that's a huge task of urban restructuring.
I appreciate that answer. I think I'm going to link to that Guardian article on the show notes page, because I think my listeners will get a kick out of the sheer horror of the author.
Listen, I tell you, I mean, the Guardian is, I used to be a Guardian reader, but it's getting worse and worse with this kind of so biased, so ideologically charged up. And I was disappointed with the journalist. He's actually usually more moderate, but he has his audience to cater for. And I gave him a full 3 hours trying to lay out my reasoning, where I'm coming from, what my concerns are, to prevent this kind of headline grabbing. But it didn't work. I think he has something to deliver to. He has an audience maybe who wants to be fed these enemies.
Well, I've decided after having been interviewed by, you know, the Washington Post and all these major places, I've decided I'm not doing that again if I'm asked, unless I put them on here, I tell them I'm recording it, and I will use the interview as an episode of my podcast.
Oh, that's great.
If they don't treat me fairly, I will say, look, I'll tell the world, this is what I actually said, and you can hear it with your own ears.
Exactly.
Plus, I'm lazy, and it gives me an extra episode of the podcast, so that also helps. Well, wonderful to talk to you. I'm glad you're speaking out. I mean, maybe you are going to inspire other people to be courageous, and what you're saying needs to be said. And man, these people live in such an echo chamber. Oh, they can't imagine living in a real world where there's a genuine exchange of ideas. I say let's usher them into that world, and you're doing a great job of that. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much, Tom. This was a pleasure.
All right, everybody. Before you go, I want to tell you about a story from jury duty today. Has nothing to do with this episode, but what the heck? I've got a microphone. I have a story. I'm going to tell it to you. I had jury duty today, and after about a couple of hours of sitting there waiting, probably 3 hours of just sitting in the jury room waiting for numbers to be announced, I was number 148. My number was indeed called, and we were led into the courtroom, and a series of questions from the judge to the potential jurors began. There were 56 of us in the room. I didn't survive to the round where the lawyers then asked questions of the potential jurors. I only made it through the judge round. And I know I could have sat there and not said anything about supporting jury nullification, and I know that's a reasonable strategy some people pursue, but I just couldn't help myself because the judge said this, something like this. He said, "I need to know whether or not you guys would have any problem following instructions. When I tell you that this is the law and I give you these instructions, even if what I say to you sounds silly or stupid, is there anybody here who would have any trouble following my instructions?" Well, there's something in me. There's no way I could sit there and not raise my hand for that. So I put up my hand. Of course, I'm the only one out of the 56. The others are probably doing what, let's face it, I probably would have done 20 years earlier, not really knowing any better. So I'm not trying to say I'm superior to these people. I wouldn't have known any better either. I wouldn't have come across the information. But implicitly, what are you saying by not putting your hand up? Yes, no matter how silly or stupid the instructions you give me, I will follow them. I just can't wrap my head around that. So I did put my hand up. So he wanted clarification. And I said, I just thought for the sake of honesty and transparency that I should make clear that my published work contains, and I just, this is as far as I went, I didn't even say jury nullification. I said contains advocacy for the rights of juries that I think are is not observed necessarily in this courtroom. And then he wanted further clarification. He said, did I believe in, I think he said something like, did I believe that juries have some inherent pardonability? And so I clarified and I said, I believe that juries have the right to judge both the law and the facts. And then he asked whether or not in this particular case, which was, I don't want to get in trouble, but let's say it was a pretty serious case, could I nevertheless follow the instructions? Now, in this particular case, I think it's almost a certainty I would have had no problem following the instructions because there didn't seem to be any moral ambiguity there. But all the same, I was dismissed. But I guess what just gets me, and I immediately came home and told one of my kids, was sitting in that room, having that judge say that or ask us that question, and there was only one hand that went up. So anyway, I hope that'll be their hand someday also. Or maybe we become more successful on this whole jury nullification thing. But I don't know. I'm still I guess I can't say I'm surprised, but nevertheless, it's just kind of a glum feeling that I don't want to be the only hand going up at that point, but I was. All right. That's all I have to say to you for today. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you are enjoying the show, I hope you will consider becoming a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com. Wait till you see the goodies I have for you. It's almost ridiculous what I've got for you over at supportinglisteners.com. I do appreciate people who help me out. Thanks so much. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.